Welcome to the Future Christian Podcast, your source for insights and ideas on how to lead your church into the 21st century. At the Future Christian Podcast, we talk to pastors, authors, and other faith leaders for helpful advice and practical wisdom to help you and your community of faith walk boldly into the future. Now, here's your host, Lauren Richmond Jr.
Welcome to the Future Christian Podcast. Today we're welcoming the Reverend Dr. Ted Smith. Ted is Charles Howard Candler Professor of Divinity and Associate Dean of Faculty at Emory University's Candler School of Theology. He holds degrees from Duke University, Oxford University, Princeton Theological Seminary, and Emory University. He is the author of three books, The New Measures, We're John Brown, and most recently, The End of Theological Education, which reviewers have hailed as a generational landmark in reflection on theological education. He has edited books on sexuality and ordination, contemporary issues in preaching, and economic inequality. Smith also serves as director of Theological Education Between the Times and the editor of the series of books that have grown out of that project. Ordained to ministry in the Presbyterian Church USA, Smith served as pastor of two congregations in upstate New York prior to beginning his doctoral studies. Let's welcome Ted to the show. Welcome to the Future Christian Podcast. This is Lauren Richmond Jr., and today I am pleased to be joined by the Reverend Dr. Ted Smith. So thank you for being here, and welcome to the show.
Thanks so much. It's a treat to be here.
Great. Looking forward to having this conversation. What else would you like to share with our listeners about yourself?
Well, not in my bio. I don't think any of the bio that you might use are my family connections, and those are really important for this book. This book is dedicated to my parents, who are very deep in the world of voluntary associations. They manifest. My mother manifested. She's passed now. My father continues to. Many of the highest virtues of that world, and that was certainly what they raised me to do. And it's also written with my sons very much in mind. They're 17 and 15, and I am passionate about thinking about what a church that is life-giving for them is going to look like. Mm-hmm. And so it's very much a book about how do I hand down or hand on the real living heart of what my parents gave to me to that next generation.
Yeah. Teasing a little bit of the content there, aren't you?
Not on purpose. I'm just telling you where the book came from.
No, it's good.
I think quite some of the passion behind it, I think, is because of those personal ties.
Yeah, I'm sure. Share, if you would, kind of about your faith story, your faith journey, what it looked like in the past and what that looks like today.
Sure. Well, as I said, I'm a child of the church through and through. My family have been Presbyterians since before we can remember. We don't know of a generation that wasn't, and especially involved in a single congregation in my hometown of Springfield, Missouri. So my grandparents, my great-grandparents, my parents all had helped to lead that church as passionate lay leaders. And so I think growing up, what being Christian meant to me was sustaining that institutional church. It meant being a good person, you know, high moral standards. It meant giving to the community. And then it meant serving and sustaining that church in every way that you could. And I think that was the faith I was raised with. There wasn't a lot of emphasis on that was the spirituality, mm-hmm. I would say, right, was that institutional sustenance. And I think I still value institutions very highly. I think the book reflects that. But I think in the course of my faith journey, I would now describe the center of my faith is that in Jesus Christ, God has made a decisive move for the redemption of the world. And that move is unfolding in history, and that our work is to respond faithfully to that work and join it from the moment in history in which we find ourselves. And that's both more and less than the sustenance of institutions.
Yeah. What are some spiritual practices that you find meaningful in your life that you're willing to share?
Sure. You know, I think my first vocation is really as a preacher. I think that's literal in the temporal sense, and it's probably also it works metaphorically as a kind of it is the vocation that has priority over others and defines others. So the simple act of preparing for preaching is for me, and then delivering the sermon. That is a deep spiritual practice for me. It is a source of joy. It's a source of life, communion with God. So I'm always happy when I'm able to do that. I think related to that are disciplines of Lectio Divina, which I pair with exegesis in sermon preparation, and then centering prayer. So those are kind of bedrock for me. I'm an ecumenical oblate of a Benedictine monastery in upstate New York, and I think that's where especially the Lectio and the centering prayer kind of took shape for me.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thanks for sharing that. So Ted is on the show here to talk about his book, The End of Theological Education, and there's no like subtitle here. I'm just noticing is there. It's just short and sweet. Most books have a long subtitle. So The End of Theological Education here, and I read the book I think a couple months ago now, but I've been looking forward to having this conversation with Ted for a while. So we're going to kind of jump in. Hopefully there's a lot here in the book. So I think let's start by talking about like the background of formal education and churches in the United States.
Yeah. The formal theological education in the U.S. Yeah. The book has a strong historical slant. And I think that's because to understand the present moment, we have to understand how we got to where we are. And so the book begins with what I call borrowing language from what the social order in Connecticut, the standing orders. Mm-hmm. And the standing orders were what Europeans brought to the United States in their imagination, and it was shaped by the Treaty of Westphalia and the way that the religious violence in Europe was resolved, which was to say that each political unit will have one established religious body, one established church. So nobody was really able to do that in North America, but that is what they brought with them in their imaginations. It's what the Puritans were dissenters in England, right? Mm-hmm. But they wanted to establish a purified church in North America. So too, the Anglican settlers of Virginia, they brought this kind of standing order imagination. And in the standing order, this was true in Europe, and it was true in the earliest university colleges in the United States, Harvard, Yale, and William and Mary down in Virginia. There really is no distinction between the regular curriculum and theological education. The regular curriculum for all undergrads is thoroughly theological because the standing order itself is theological. Mm-hmm. So to take your place in it, whether as governor or as a teacher in the college or as a pastor or as a lawyer, whatever, to take your place in that standing order is to be theologically educated. So there wasn't really a stark separation. Pastors then would just get a little kind of postgraduate apprenticeship with somebody who knew the kind of craft of pastoring. But the theological education was part of everybody's undergraduate. Well, in the early national period, with the founding of the nation, and with the revivals that were very much a part of this story, you just couldn't sustain that vision of a unified standing order anymore, certainly not on a national scale. So you get a separation between church and state politically, and then that's mirrored educationally with the founding of a new kind of institution, which is the seminary. Andover Seminary, Theological Seminary, founded in 1807. They were critical of Harvard, but they didn't found a new Harvard. They founded a new place that was dedicated entirely to the training of ministers. Now, that became the norm in the United States over the next 200 years. But it's worth remembering that it's actually a fairly new kind of thing, right? That it wasn't the norm before. It's not how any of the Puritans or early Anglican pastors were trained here. And it's certainly not the norm through the millennia and across the continents. But that's the form that really took shape and became dominant in the United States.
Yeah, so you talk about in the book this move from that standing order to what you call, or perhaps others call, but you use the term too in the book, voluntary associations. So share about that, kind of that transition from the standing order, as you call it, to the voluntary associations.
Yeah, it's from the established church to a model that is very familiar to those of us who are connected to churches today, a model in which you have multiple denominations that are together under, maybe in a more or less contentious way, but together under a canopy that is defined largely by the nation state. They exist together under that canopy. So how did that come to be? It's always worth remembering, I think, that when the standing orders had kind of run their course, when they no longer fit the imagination of people, church membership in the United States was very low, church adherence. So at the time of the Revolution, by one good estimate, it's about 17% of Americans are affiliated formally with a congregation. Now, that number needs nuancing because the standards for formal affiliation were sometimes very high. Yeah. There might have been a wider penumbra. But still, the church was badly out of sync with the national imagination in 1776, and the numbers reflected it. What the revivals did, they were... The revivals of the Second Great Awakening, especially those early national revivals, they were a revolution in worship style, for sure, that fit with these new democratic times. They were also a revolution in institutional style. So you move from an established church to churches that were these voluntary associations where people of like mind got together. They might have called their pastor, right? They had that kind of power rather than a bishop appointing them. And then they funded themselves not through taxes, because the funding by taxation went away in the first three decades of the 19th century. They funded themselves through donations. So you've got a really new kind of organization that emerges in those first decades of the 19th century. And that's the congregation as voluntary association. And, this was shocking to outside observers when Alexis de Tocqueville comes to the United States. He's a French aristocrat. Mm-hmm. His imagination is shaped entirely by the old Westphalian standing orders. And so he's like, well, if they don't have that, it's just going to be chaos here. and it's going to be atheism, because mm-hmm. how would you have a church
right.
if it's not established? So he comes here, though, and he sees this incredible religious vitality, for one thing. And he also sees not chaos, but people organizing themselves into these voluntary associations with all this dynamism and energy that's just surprising to him. And then he gives us a brilliant chronicle of that. But it's worth remembering how new that was and what a kind of revelation it was at that moment in history.
I'm thinking as you were talking, assuming I have my history correct, the denomination I'm ordained in, the Christian Church of Disciples of Christ, is really a product, right, of this process.
Absolutely.
Right?
Cain Ridge and right. the whole Restorationist tradition
right.
was really one of the revival at Cain Ridge was one of the most powerful and influential revivals that kind of rolled out of that early national period. But a lot of the disciples, the Church of Christ mm-hmm. emphasis, you see it in the kind of the very democratic notion of pastoral leadership.
Right.
The democratic sense that anyone can celebrate the Eucharist, right? We're going to share that around. It was there in the preaching style. It's there in the polity. It's even there in the ecumenism, mm-hmm. Because there's an ambivalence about being a denomination. We don't want to be a denomination. We're just a church. But there's still that sense that all Christians are actually connected.
Right.
But they're not connected in the in that restorationist mind as a state church.
Mm-hmm.
They would be connected as like one mega denomination, that kind of thing. So, yeah, you're exactly right. This is your DNA, and it's kind of mine too, because my Presbyterian roots are in the Cumberland Presbyterian, which is like
right.
kissing cousins to
yeah.
disciples.
Yeah, I was fortunate to be at Cane Ridge last summer as part of when the disciples had their General Assembly in Louisville, and they took a trip out there. And to me, it's holy ground. And I don't say that as like someone who's like committed in the wool to disciples. I say that as, you know, a place where something supernatural, if I can use that word, like took place. But yeah, for sure, that interesting, like how much correlation there is there. I was just like thinking, like, do I need to look back at my what's the book? Stone Campbell Encyclopedia, make sure I have the dates right before I ask that question.
But you've got it.
Yeah. So, you know, in the context, so maybe we'll talk here at least through my reference point of like the Christian Church Disciples of Christ. When did this, because again, thinking back even to disciples' history, like, and the even broader speaking, like, you know, I've worked in the Methodist Church, and there was certainly like a, you know, the writing preacher, what's the word? You know,
circuit writer.
Yeah, the circuit writing preacher. There wasn't like the professional, like, full time pastor as we think of today. When did that model really begin to take shape?
Yeah, that's a great question. That model of the kind of settled professional pastor had a very uneasy relationship with the revivals, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because the revivals were often challenging the credibility and the authority of exactly those kinds of pastors. And often the people who were doing that challenging were women and children and enslaved people or formerly enslaved black citizens for whom ordination was not always going to be an easy path, mm-hmm. right? It was really an upsetting of that kind of hierarchy. And you're exactly right to say that the circuit riding Methodists and the kind of there's a kind of charism that was attached to the circuit riders that was not easily domesticated. And, you know, Methodists retain a sense of itinerancy in their elders that is supposed to echo that and carry that charism forward. And I think it's more or less practiced. But it's a reflection of that ongoing uneasiness. It really happened, though, for these traditions that we're talking about, the more revival-oriented traditions, it happened across the early decades of the 19th century. A key figure in that is Charles Grandison Finney, the great revivalist. Mm-hmm. My first book, The New Measures, is on him. And, you know, he was trained as a lawyer. And in many ways, what Finney did was to take that ecstatic revival energy and channel it into more respectable forms. So nobody was, you know, taking off their clothes and running around in the Holy Ghost power
mm-hmm.
at a Finney revival. That wasn't going to happen. But there was still that new kind of energy that then was grafted into the mores of an emerging professional class. So that's happening especially across the 1820s and 1830s. In the South, with Methodists, a similar process is happening. Christine Lee Herrmann has a beautiful book on this, Southern Cross, that kind of shows the gradual assimilation of Methodist pastors into these more settled and quasi-professional roles. They really, you see the real professionalization of ministry, though, across the 19th century. And then it really is taking hold in the 20th century. And I mean professional here in a very kind of strict social science kind of sense, like from Max Weber. The professional is neither labor nor capital. The professional is part of a guild that has a certain amount of autonomy, mm-hmm. that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the professional has a special education just for them. And so the professionalization of ministry happens across the 19th and then the 20th century. And it's important that really ministers were in some ways, the first professionals in the U.S. You have theological schools before you have medical schools, before you have law schools proper, right? So the education differentiates sooner, and the ministry kind of emerges as a professional class sooner. But then medicine and law join it, and then other professions as well.
So like these other more established denominations, like I'm thinking like the Congregationalists, Presbyterians, would they have already had this kind of professionalization or have been more informal?
That's a great question. They were warmer to the more settled ministry patterns, right? To have one pastor in a place. And it's one reason they didn't grow, right? They just, in the same way that Baptists and Methodists just took off, disciples as well, took off in this early national period. And the Presbyterians and Congregationalists, who had more numbers at the, you know, at the turn of the century, they had more numbers, but they didn't grow because they didn't hitch themselves to the revivals. And part of that was because of their commitment to a settled, that settled ministry. So they already had the people who were in place, you know, with authority over a congregation. That ministry professionalized, though, over the course of the 19th century. They weren't fully professionals in the early decades of the 19th century. They were more like, it was still kind of a holdover of the old standing order. They were more like a local squire or something, right? A kind of echo of an old, almost feudal kind of order. But then it becomes professional later on. And one way you can see that is ministers didn't used to move around a lot. And so if you were in a place, you were of that place. But a key feature of professionalism is that you get a credential.
Right.
You've got an MDiv.
Right.
You've got an ordination paper.
Yep.
And you've got an MD, you've got a JD, and you've passed your boards. And you can take that credential and move around with it. Right.
Yeah.
And you don't move, you know, in the real professional model at the way the bishop moves you. You choose when you move. And so then you get the kind of you get a career path that's appropriate to professionals. Like you start with a small church, you go to a bigger one, and then you go to a bigger one, and then you retire. And you have and retirement is possible. You don't have to work till you die. Right. Because that's that movement into a professional class. And there's a pension plan. You know, the denomination has a pension plan.
Yeah. It is interesting thinking about that model of the more – of the denominations or groups that really had to use the term hustle. Like they experienced the more growth, and we kind of see that – maybe this will play into our conversation more. Like I think we really still see that today in many ways. Like the clergy that still have to quote-unquote hustle, to use a term, like those churches tend to be – not always, of course, but it seems like there's a correlation there with more church growth and vitality. So it's an interesting dynamic there. I feel like we're staying in this professionalization conversation for a while, so hopefully that's okay here. But so we've kind of built the background. So let's talk now about the challenges of this professionalization model.
Yeah, I think there's two challenges or problems or sites of ambivalence, however you want to frame it. One of them has to do with social class and what happens with the professionalization of ministry, especially in the denominations where it happens the most, right, where they really, really do kind of enter that professional class, is that you get an alienation of church leadership from poor people.
Yeah.
And even from working people. And sometimes, you know, I think ministers, even when we were fully professionalized, the salary often wasn't there. But a profession is not just about income, it's about social class.
Right.
And when you have a ministry that is a part of the professional class, well, then it just creates relational obstacles in connecting with working and poorer people. And I think that's one reason why you see the denominations that most professionalized their ministry really ceased connecting to working class and poor people in America. And to me, I mean, my denomination did that. That is what we did. And I think it's a scandal of the gospel. And it's not just because what Jesus is doing is not just doing good things for poor people, right? From a position of relative privilege,
right.
Which is the core of the professional ethos, right? But no, what Jesus is doing is a deep form of solidarity with the poorest people around him. And the professionalization of ministry blocks that in a deep way. So that's one real crisis, I think, that it creates. And I think a second one is a more subtle theological problem. Because the professional, deep in the professional ethos, especially a professional ministry ethos, is that you want to make the world a better place.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a bad thing.
Right.
It does happen from a position of power.
Right.
I'm going to use my social power to make the world a better place. I mean, that's what I was raised to do, right? Use your power to make the world a better place. But I think the problem with that theologically is that it often uses theology and all the stuff of church life, the church, the sacraments, preaching, all of that becomes instrumental to the transformation of society. So our talk about God, we want to talk about God in a way that's going to bring about the kind of changes that we want to see. That's an instrumentalization of theology. But the thing is, that gets the relationship exactly wrong, right? God is not a tool in our hands to do what we want to do.
Yeah.
And instrumentalizing theology, instrumentalizing the sacraments, worship, all of this stuff, it brings a deep distortion into it. And I think the professional model invites that. So those are two crises that I think were kind of baked into the model, and I think you see all kinds of reactions to them. Another one, I mean, that goes right along with the class piece is just the way in which professionalism is tied to a politics of respectability.
Yeah.
And I think a younger generation, especially of Black scholars and activists, have really clarified the limits and just the deep problems with the politics of respectability.
We may not get past this professionalism part because there's so much here. Like, as you're talking about, like, the alienation, I'm thinking, like, again, as someone who has standing in my denomination, like, I have to take boundaries classes. And I was thinking about, like, and this leads into another question I was going to ask you, like how much of this is, how much of these kind of, like, professionalism models are really tied into, like, what we'd call mainline institutions versus, like, more evangelical traditions like Baptists or even now, you know, non-denoms. Because, like, I'm thinking, like, you know, as a – I was trained, I'll say, like, as someone who's ordained, like, you don't have friends in your church ministry context, right? You're supposed to have some fairly, I don't know, secure boundaries, I guess. Which again, kind of thinking about implications, right, can lead to this really isolation and loneliness for clergy, which I've read a few good books out. But like I'm thinking about, like, I have some good relationships with evangelical folks, church folks, and like talking to their pastors, like the idea that you can't be friends with a clergy, you know, or friends with your parishioners is bizarre. So like, again, I'm kind of long-winded here, but like, is this a thing that has not, is this a problem somewhat unique to these mainline traditions, I guess is what I'm asking.
Yeah. It's definitely native to what we call the mainline.
Yeah.
So that's where it is. Yeah. It's where those trends are deepest. With that said, I think, the Master of Divinity is a professional degree,
mm-hmm.
and ATS is the Association of Theological Schools, which certifies those schools that offer an MDiv, is very clear about enforcing those kind of standards so that it becomes a professional education. Now, people might undergo that with, you know, their fingers crossed behind their back, or it might not take very deeply, but if you have an MDiv, then you've received a professional education.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, one of the I talk about this in the book, one of the most striking things about the last half of the 20th century is the way in which all kinds of Christian traditions have moved to professional theological education.
Right.
That's true of Catholics, which you could say, you know, does that really fit with the Catholic theology of the priesthood? Hmm. Not so sure. But if you've got an ATS accredited Catholic institution, then there's a professional formation that's happening there. Does that fit with Pentecostals? But the Assemblies of God has sought, as has Kojic, they have sought ATS accreditation for their MDivs. And there's if you really want to be a leader in those denominations, now you better go get your seminary education, right? So there's those kinds of, so on the one hand, at the latter part of the 20th century, saw that spreading across movements and denominations, including evangelical ones very much. I think what we're seeing now, though, is a real, and this is at the heart of the book, is an unraveling mm-hmm. of the professionalization of ministry. That's unraveling. And with it, the congregation as voluntary association and the notion of a denomination. All those things go together. Professional ministry, professional education, the congregation as voluntary association, and the denomination. And all four of those things are unraveling together. And so I'm trying to think about, what does theological education look like now? What does ministry look like now? What's the form of the congregation or a local gathering of Christians?
Yeah. Boy, there's, like I said, there's so much here to talk about. Hopefully this is not being the same drum here of professionalization and ministry, so forgive me if you're trying to move the conversation along. But I'm thinking, I just heard this, I think, recently from Tom Rainer, the SBC guy. He mentioned something like in a podcast I was listening to, like a really small, surprisingly small percentage of SBC pastors have even a bachelor's, I think he said. And then I'm mm-hmm. also thinking about in the Calvary tradition, if I understand this correctly, and I think I do, folks can kind of just train informally, almost like an apprenticeship. So this kind of, I think this kind of broadens out into one of the themes you talk about, at least as I understand it in this book, this need for a more, I don't know if this is the right word, more specialized approach to ministry.
Yeah. I do think we're seeing all kinds of signs of the formation of Christian leaders that are happening outside of professional education. That's really expanding mm-hmm. now. So I think the 20th century saw this incredible, it is really a remarkable consolidation
right.
of the forms of training across the denominations. And the forms of the institutions too. So there was that consolidation, and now I think it's a time of unraveling, and that means there's all kinds of other energy. There's all kinds of other things that are developing, like some of the ones you name. And what I'm calling for in the book, I'm very careful, I think, not to give a blueprint for a next theological education,
yeah.
because I really believe. I mean, it's a theological conviction for me. That's going to come about only as groups of Christians gather together for faithful discernment in their place, from their tradition, with their folk. That's how it's going to happen. Because if I just hand down the blueprint from the fifth floor of Candler School of Theology at Emory University,
yeah.
it's just a replication
yeah.
of that professional model. So I'm not going to. I don't think there's any good in that, and I don't. It might make for cleaner talking points, but that's not what I'm trying to do. So instead, what I offer are a series of renunciations.
Mm-hmm.
If the professional model is over, well, then we need to give up professional status.
Mm-hmm.
We need to stop pretending to be in that kind of space. We need to give up the instrumentalizing relationship to theological knowledge, and we need to give up the financial model for theological education as professional education, which relies on student debt.
Yeah.
But which could be justified if you become a professional, well then,
right.
It could be worth it to go in. But that's not what's happening anymore. And then I try to name some affordances that people can discern in the world as it is. It's more trying to bring the church to self-consciousness and then provide resources for discernment. And I think and hope that what comes out of it is going to be, it's going to be richly plural. It's going to be different traditions and different communities pursuing different paths. I think that's what the church needs right now.
Yeah. So let's talk if we can here just about some perhaps challenges of this kind of this new vision you have, at least as I see them, and I think you kind of lay these out in the book, if I understood you correctly. But you talk about like this move towards smaller and more homogenous denominations, and I think at least in my context, I feel like we're kind of seeing that. I mean, quite literally, like with the United Methodist Church, right? Like the splintering, right, from the global Methodist Church to now, you know, there's a smaller but certainly more progressive, liberal, whatever you want. Like, I think I just got an email like, hey, we can really celebrate that we're now a progressive denomination. You know, the same thing has happened in every mainline denomination, I think, right, has gone through some sort of splintering, often around the issue of LGBTQ or gay marriage, you know, in the past. So obviously there are some strengths to that, you know, whether it be like more focused clarity on mission and values and ethos. But what are some drawbacks, do you think, of this really like smaller, more homogeneous units?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it is exactly the dynamic that I see right now. I think where that fits in the larger story that I'm trying to tell is that when the voluntary associations really have their power, they almost have a kind of aura. Hmm. And sustaining the denomination, sustaining the congregation, that becomes in itself a worthwhile activity.
Yeah.
It's so important. And that's absolutely true for my parents and their generation of, you know, to be Presbyterian and to sustain First and Calvary Presbyterian Church. Like, this was at the center of their faith. And I have enormous respect for that and the sacrifices they made to do that. But what you get with the kind of individualization that I name and the expressive qualities that attend to that are there's a big shift in people's relationship to the institution. And now it becomes more important that I get to express myself and that the institution reflect my values than that it simply be sustained.
Mm-hmm.
And one way you know that is, you know, the denominations were, like, they held together. When people lost votes, they worked to win next year,
right.
But they stayed.
Right.
Like, and they stayed because the institution meant so much to them. And now, if people lose votes, they leave.
Right.
They're out.
Right.
That's tied to this kind of what Robert Bella et al. Call an expressive individualism. So Robert Wuthnow, the great sociologist, named the rise of special purpose groups within denominations
mm-hmm.
that were almost like lobbying bodies, advocacy groups. And I think what's happened in the last 20 years since he spotted those groups, and those groups often connected much more deeply with people because they were more expressive of what
right,
they really care
right.
about and of their identity and their values. But what's happened is not that any of those groups took over a denomination. It's rather that through the fracturing, the denominations kind of became special purpose groups.
Yeah.
And so they're more expressive for people. And I think that's where you get the celebratory email that you were referencing. Hey, finally, the denomination can reflect our values. They're smaller, more homogeneous, just as you say. So what are the challenges of that? I think one of the biggest challenges of that is figuring out how these different bodies are going to relate to one another.
Yeah.
Because the denominational ethos, and this is why many people, that is there in ecumenism, the denominational ethos at the heart of it is, hey, you may be a Wesleyan, you may be a Calvinist, you may be a Thomist, whatever, but we all have a sense of being, like, all of these traditions are valid
right.
in some way,
right.
at least deserving the respect of the state. And, we have a place for them as part of a larger national mission. So I think part of the problem with the old denominational ethos is the way that it made a sort of idol out of the state.
Mm-hmm.
The state was that which was holding all of the church together. But the challenge now is with these new, more expressive denominations, it's harder for them to want the other ones to continue to exist.
Right. Yeah.
They would like for them just to disappear, and to find any kind of common cause starts to feel really, really problematic. So I think that's the great challenge that we have. The other thing that's really interesting, though, it's a misreading, I think, of the present moment. If what you see is a breaking of denominations, the biggest movement that's happening right now are congregations just moving out of denominations, even if they're officially still in.
Right.
But they, a really wealthy mainline denomination or mainline church, they might run all their own ministries. They might have their own missionaries. They're kind of becoming increasingly they're doing a lot of the things the denomination used to do themselves.
Right.
And a large number of the churches that left in the most recent Presbyterian and Methodist splits, they're not even joining the so-called conservative denomination. Mm-hmm. They're just going out on their own.
Yep.
And that, I think, there's a way in which that fits the times, right? You're not part of this larger thing. It's you're part of a congregation that's more expressive and closer to the individualized individuals that are at its heart.
Yeah, it's interesting, because on both sides of that, I'm thinking about, I think it's Church of the Resurrection, right? The Methodist Church in Kansas City. They're still part of the denomination. And I think, what's his name? Hamilton, is quick to point out
Hamilton,
that
yeah.
they're proud to be United Methodist. But like you said, it's not like – I could be wrong here, but I don't think they're necessarily using everything from Abington or whatever the publishers are. I think, again
– Or their associate pastor just recently became the director of the press at Abington.
Oh, interesting.
So, yeah.
Kind of reverse there, right?
Yeah. And they've convened meetings.
Right.
And none of this is criticism.
Right, right.
It's just to kind of name sociologically the dynamic.
Right.
Where really, and you see it even in you see it in money.
Yeah,
denominations at least experience themselves as broke.
Right.
Right. Oh my gosh, we don't. But so where is the money concentrated in Christianity in America today? It's concentrated in large congregations or wealthy congregations through endowments or through present giving.
So do you think this is something that gives the evangelicals a big? I mean, certainly broadly speaking. The SBC would be part of evangelicalism, and they're certainly going through their own institutional challenges. But do you think, because of the light or the lack of overhead, so to speak, from non-denoms, there's some loose networks and such. Do you think that gives them? I hate to say advantage.
I think.
Yeah, go ahead.
That, yeah, you would say, are they better adapted
right,
to the
right.
times? And here, I would. I think. Evangelical versus mainline as theological markers, I think, will lead you astray.
Yeah, that's fair.
Because the SBC has seen a decline in baptisms
right.
and a decline in membership now for 15 years.
Yeah.
It's been precipitous.
Yeah.
And they're, Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary, I recently read, has seen an 80% decline in the number of MDivs. Hmm. So, But here, note the key. What's declining? The denomination.
Yeah.
What's declining? The seminary that provides professional education. So both of those are well adjusted to that older order of voluntary associations. Now, where do you see the growth? You see the growth and the vitality in the places that are well adapted to this present moment of individualized individuals. And I do think a megachurch is that.
Yeah.
Megachurches are better adapted to this. And here's why. They often are designed to give you a chance for that kind of ecstatic, expressive experience. And that's true in worship. But I want to reject the denominationalist critique of the megachurch that says, it's just a consumer spirituality. No, but some of the things that can happen in those small groups, mm-hmm. which are the necessary component,
right.
can be profound study of the scripture, profound work of discipleship. And I also want to push back and be, it's not obvious to me that serving on the building and grounds committee makes one closer to Jesus than being part of a small group and then going to ecstatic worship.
Yeah.
Those are the different, ethoses that are in play there. So I do think that the megachurch is better adapted to the times, for better and worse. Mm-hmm. I also think house churches often are. And the key there in both cases is that you're not asking members to sustain the institution with their labor, with their voluntary labor. Because, and in the megachurch, it's because paid staff does it.
I'm thinking, I was just thinking like the megachurch near me in my neck of the woods, like at least one of the two big ones. Like they have like a Christian school. Like I think they have some kind of like theological training center now. Like they're really, they're becoming like a mini denomination almost in their own right. Which leads me, something you said, I want to ask real quick, like your thoughts on this. Like my thought is like in the future, like the really, the best – I don't know, forms of church are going to be, like you said, the micro church and the mega church. Like these churches in the middle are just going to get squeezed out. Do you think that's fair?
Already happening demographically. Right. I mean, all the numbers point to that.
So it's almost like you're better off being a micro church than you are being a church of 150, right?
And there are more such churches. Yeah. I think it depends, though. There's a lot of different ways to be a so-called micro church. Yeah, I think what I would want And I say this as one who is pastor of two small membership congregations in a rural area myself. Mm-hmm. I think the most important thing in those kind of settings is to embrace that smaller form instead of trying – like what's death is to have 75 members trying to sustain a congregational model that really takes 200 members. Yeah. And then everybody's just exhausted and burned out. And if somebody new, miracle of God, walks through the door, everybody just descends on them like vampires. And it's like, hey, you've been here 2 weeks. Would you like to chair the Christian Education Committee? Because the institution needs the life, right? But when we spot that vampire dynamic, that's when we should say, okay, that's not church, right? Church should be giving life. But I think there are super strong models of congregations that are very small. They might function more like extended families, even if it's not necessarily a blood family, but that's the logic of them. They might have really low institutional overhead. That's in terms of cost, like their space, but it's also in terms of their committee structure and their finances, their personnel, all that. I think those can, and a lot of the so-called fresh expressions movements, they fit that model, and they tap into the desire for expressive individualism that I think is very much kind of a sign of the times. And intimate community, not in a committee meeting, but in a Bible study in which we're talking out of the issues in our lives.
Okay, I know I'm keeping you along here, so let me ask you one more question here before we take a break. And there's so much more I wanted to get to, but like I said, I knew there's going to be a lot of stuff here. So let's talk about this expressive individualism. That certainly is the water we're swimming in, the air we're breathing right now in our context. You write in your book like this shift in institutional roles from formation to platforms. Like denominations almost are seen as like, quite literally platforms to help someone express themselves or be their full selves. Like, in thinking about this model, and as I understand, you kind of advocate for seminaries taking on a more individualistic approach in ministry. Like, what is the danger of are we adapting too much to the culture? Like, we're kind of like feeding this thing that's really not a healthy dynamic. Does that make sense?
Yeah, for sure. The formation versus platform distinction that I'm trying to make there is, I think you see it clearly in a congregational level where, a congregation, there's a way in which the professional minister, one of the virtues of a good professional minister is they really serve the institution and they get what authority they have from the institution. So they stand, if you were to draw it, they stand under the institution, holding it up. Right. And what I think we're seeing now increasingly is pastors of large churches, they're not standing under that institution holding it up. They're standing on top of it, and it is their platform that lets them reach even more people.
Well, if I can interrupt there, sorry. Yeah. Like, I'm just thinking, like, I'm an example of this right now. Like, there's so many clergy my age who are just like, we're not willing to, from a crumbling institution, we're not willing to hold that up and get crushed by it, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, this is the this is where I'm an old style reformed, like in my theological DNA. Mm-hmm. I'm deeply ambivalent about the voluntary association model. It did crush people. Making the voluntary association central had all, you know, it had the professionalization problems that I named. Mm-hmm. I'm ambivalent about that, and I'm deeply ambivalent about the order that is emerging now. I think theologically, God is, you know, there have been no unambivalent moments in human history. Hmm. All the moments in human history have been shot through with sin, and God has, in God's graciousness, has decided to work through human history for the redemption of the world. So that's what I think is happening now. And that's where I think the idea I would absolutely want to resist, and I really loathe the kind of writing that it takes like a little pop sociology mm-hmm. or something, and then is like shows the church how to conform better to the age.
Right.
Basically, that's what it's doing.
Right.
Well, that's not theology. That's advertising, you know, or like that's the... So I don't want to do that. I think we have to do the, you know, sociological work through theological lenses so that we know what our moment in history looks like and we're not deceiving ourselves. But then I think we have a critical relationship to that. So I'm not calling for a more individualistic mode of theological education at all. I do name individualization as an affordance for theological education, but it's a very indirect one. Like the biggest way in which it's an affordance is in some ways it's terrible. This individualization that we have, it carves people out of communities.
Right.
It leaves them on their own
right.
without any kind of story to orient their lives,
right.
and then it charges them with building all on their own an authentic self.
Yep.
Well, I wonder why anxiety is so widespread. Like that's just. It's a terrible kind of condition that a lot of people are in right now, right? And I think if what theological education is designed to do is to say, hey, we're going to give you professional credentials to go lead these crumbling voluntary associations. Well, people aren't interested in that, like just like what you're saying, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if theological education says, hey, I see this enormous challenge that that the world has given you, that you have to put a life before God together, and you have to figure out all the, you know, and there's actually learning through the centuries that can help you do that. Well, that's a different purpose for theological education. It's less professional education, and it's more like, oriented towards helping individuals put selves together. And a lot of our students are already doing that. They get an MDiv and then they go into social work. They get an MDiv, they
chaplaincy.
Go on to law school. Chaplaincy.
Yeah.
Well, and chaplaincy to me is like one of the signature forms of our time for religious life. Because what is a chaplain? A religious leader who isn't part of a voluntary association.
Hmm.
Right, they're not leading a voluntary. So they're employed usually in a a for profit
right.
or a not profit hospital, military, corporation, and there's no building and grounds meeting for a chaplain, right? And a chaplain doesn't need to invite anybody to do that work, right? So they are the religious leader, kind of emancipated from or stripped of leading a voluntary association, and I think that's why that like students want to do
right.
that, and there's a growing possibility for it.
All right. Well, we're already like 53 minutes in, and
sorry, I've been talking too much.
I want to talk for another 53 minutes, but I unfortunately have other things to do, and I'm sure you do. So I really appreciate the time. Like I said, there's a lot more to talk about here. There's a lot more in the book, so I do want to recommend the book. The End of Theological Education. Who is it? Erdman. So check it out. Let's take a quick break and we'll come back with some closing questions. All right, we're back with Reverend Dr. Ted Smith. So thanks so much for the conversation. These closing questions are meant to be taken as seriously or not as you'd like to. So if you're Pope for a day, what might that day look like for you?
Well, you know, I'm a cranky old Presbyterian, so it would look like dissolving the papacy.
That tends to come up a lot here in this podcast.
Well, you need to talk to some better –
Yeah, I do. Unfortunately, I do. A theologian or historical Christian figure you'd want to meet or bring back to life?
That's interesting. Jesus.
Sure.
For sure. It's the obvious, but it, not to say it would be insane. I think another that I would really like to meet and talk with is Benedict, St. Benedict, in part because the communities that he founded have been so meaningful to me, and in part because I think he's both, he had an innovation that was theological, it was liturgical, and it was also institutional, and I think we need something on all three of those levels. And for the record, I do not think Rod Dreher's The Benedict Option understands Benedict really at all.
Oh, I like that. I like that. Okay, good, good.
So, yeah, I mean, one reason I'd like to have him back is just to say, that's not what I meant. Please don't assimilate that to your particular political battle axis that you're trying to
find. I've not read that, but I'm familiar with it, so that's intriguing. What do you think history will remember from our current time and place?
What will history remember from our current time and place? I think one thing that will be remembered is the staggering inequality of our society. The growing number of people who are homeless or who are working in jobs that, like, you can barely get by. There's just no hope. And then the, you know, the top end is just, it's just unbelievable. It's the greatest wealth the world has ever known.
Yeah.
But those two things coexisting. So not to our credit, I don't think.
Yeah. Let me reframe this last question here. What do you hope maybe for the future of church institutions?
Yeah.
Seminaries, churches? Answer how you'd like to.
Sure. Church institutions right now, I think, we feel poor and disrespected and besieged. And I think that's because we are trying to prop up a model that has lost its living connection to the times. But we are not, in fact, poor. And not just in a gospel sense, but in, like, there are real resources in all of these institutions. Money, and then just really gifted people who are ready to serve in profound ways. All of the, and ideas and traditions and practices. So there's just a lot of wealth in the full sense of that term in these institutions. And what I would love for us to do is to turn that wealth towards creating institutions that fit these times. And those will be ambivalent, just like the ones that we're inheriting are, but just to turn from that task of propping up to building what we need to build. And I want us to build something between a kind of Gnostic individualism. Mm-hmm. It's just kind of me and God off in our own little meditation app. And the kind of sustaining of the voluntary association at all costs. There's just got to be a better alternative for that. And I think we're seeing some of those alternatives already starting. So, and I want that not because I want, you know, the church exists because God has decided to use the church in ways for the redemption of the world. So that's what I really want, is that work of redemption to continue with faithful responses from us.
All right. I'm going to pop a question here. Yes, no is your choice of response. So, like, a comment has been made, like, I'm a member of the pension fund for the Christian church, that the money of the pension fund will long outlive the denomination. Yes or no question, will the money from mainline institutions outlive the institutions?
No, because the money will be used to sustain the institutions.
Okay, okay.
But I think the institutions are going to take very different forms. It's already happening.
Yeah.
As the denominations are becoming large special purpose groups instead of denominations, even if they still call themselves.
Boy, we need another 45 minutes for that. All right. Where can people connect with you, get your book, all that stuff?
I don't really do social media, so not through any of those usual channels. But I'm at Emory's Candler School of Theology. I'm happy to respond to emails as best I can at ted.smith@emory.edu. And, those are the main and best ways. They're welcome to come to Candler anytime. I'd love the conversation.
Yeah. Well, this has been, I've really appreciated the conversation, enjoyed your perspective. So thank you so much for sharing with me, and hopefully with our listeners here. So I always leave folks with a word of peace. So may God's peace be with you.
And also with you.
Thanks for joining us on the Future Christian Podcast. To learn more about Lauren or the podcast, visit future-christian.com. One more thing before you go. Do us a favor and subscribe to the podcast. And if you're feeling especially generous, leave a review. It really helps us get the word out to more people about the podcast. The Future Christian Podcast is a production of Torn Curtain Arts and Resonate Media. Our episodes were mixed by Danny Burton, and the production support is provided by Paul Romig-Levitt. Thanks, and go in peace.